This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So this hadith is narrated in a lot of different chains and is classified as being mutawatir in its kind of just abundance. It comes from a lot of different people. Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu anhuma, he's the son of Umar ibn al-Khattab. So when we looked at hadith number 3, Abdullah ibn Umar was the narrator of that hadith also. And so not to go into too much detail in his biography, because we already talked about him a lot, but he's the eldest son of Umar ibn al-Khattab. And why we want to look at the narrators of these hadith is because we want to also be able to, one, contextualize through them, right? He's the youngest son of Umar ibn al-Khattab, meaning that he's also a young person. And we want to be able to think out how he fits into the broader framework of what it is that he's narrating, right? Abdullah ibn Umar, for example, he's narrated well over 2,000 hadith or attributes to him in terms of chains of transmission. As a young person, he is one of the four Abdullahs who are just known as having a deep impact on the development of Islam. A lot of his teachings, a lot of his insights influenced the development of the Maliki school, the school associated with the people of Medina. And one of the things that's really interesting about Abdullah ibn Umar, among many things, is that he wasn't somebody who was drawn towards leadership or authority or being in a political role. His father, Umar ibn al-Khattab, is somebody that the Prophet ﷺ says within kind of a normative understanding in Sunni Islam, لَوْ كَانَ نَبِيًا بَعْدِي لَكَانَ عُمَرٍ, that if there was a messenger after me, it would be this man, Umar. He is one of the people that when the Prophet is looking for strength in his community, because in their early years, they're deeply persecuted, right? There's a lot of boycotts, beating, abuse. If you come on Wednesday nights when we talk about the prophetic biography, the Sirah, we're in this stage of the Sirah now, where they're in this initial phase of revelation, but also public propagation for the first time. They're being mistreated very heavily. And so one of the du'as that the Prophet makes is about bringing people who have like power and clout to help leverage that for the sake of their community. So he makes a dua, Allahumma izzal Islam bi ahabba rajalani ilayk, Umar ibn Hisham or Umar ibn al-Khattab, that, oh Allah, bring some izzah to Islam. And izzah is different from quwwah, right? Quwwah is physical strength. Izzah is like a strength rooted in dignity, that if you speak Urdu or Hindi, maybe Bangla, I don't know, I don't speak Bangla, but you have a word izzat, right? Which is like respect. You know, it's got this sense of dignity to it. This is what izzah is, right? So he's saying, bring that kind of strength by the one of the two men who is more beloved to you, Umar ibn Hisham or Umar ibn al-Khattab, meaning like make one of them Muslim, right? Bring this izzah to Islam. And the dua is accepted for Umar ibn al-Khattab, right? Which you can take a lot from this dua, but one of the many things that we're taught is that these two men who were adversaries, like the dua is kind of prefaced on the one who is more beloved to you, meaning that Allah still has a love for Umar ibn al-Khattab in this state pre-Islam. And now his strength is leveraged because he's a great champion on behalf of the mushrikeen. They know that he causes problems for the Muslim community. And so he is now being made dua for to leverage this. What's interesting about Umar radiallahu anhu's story of his acceptance of Islam, he's actually in a place where he's on his way to kill the messenger of God. And he gets met on the way and deterred towards his own house. The companion says, well, maybe you should look at your own home. And his sister Fatima, she's studying the verses of Surah Al-Taha with Khabbab ibn Arat, right? And to not go into too much detail, Umar radiallahu anhu, he like demands to see the pages that she's reading from, that they would have some of the verse of the Quran written at that time as a way for them to study it, but not like a bound mushaf the way we know the mushaf was bound, because the whole thing hadn't been revealed at that time, even to begin with. And so she wouldn't show it to him. They have an altercation. He like pushes her down to the ground, strikes her. She gets injured. It's bleeding. And he like gets like consciousness, right? Like he's now not hurting somebody else. He's hurting his own like people, his own clan. And in this tribal society that you are protecting your clan, you're not the hurting mechanism of your clan. He kind of realizes what it is that he has done. And they engage with the text, and it just resonates differently with him. And now he sets forward again, and they take him to where the Prophet is, and people are afraid. Hamza radiallahu anh had accepted Islam before this. He's the uncle of the Prophet. And so when Umar knocks on the door, he still has his sword with him, right? And very famously, they say he wears his sword on his neck. You know, that's how massive of a person he is, that he can actually wear it like hanging from his neck and it's not cutting into him, you know, the way you wear a necklace, like he's got this thing hanging from his neck. And they don't know, they still know him as an adversary. So when he knocks on the door, everybody jumps out of the way, except Hamza. Hamza says, I'll go open the door for him. Do you know? And Umar radiallahu anh, he now comes in, he accepts Islam. For the first time, they can walk in public. Hamza radiallahu anh and Umar radiallahu anh leading lines, two rows, and the Prophet's walking in between them. Nobody can do anything, right? He goes and knocks on Abu Jahl's door, and Abu Jahl is excited because this is his champion, right? Marhaban ya Umar, right? Like, welcome, O Umar. And Umar radiallahu anh, he says, Aslamtu, that I converted to Islam. And he says, La taf'al, don't do this. And he says, fa'alt, it's done. And now they change drastically the situation for that early community. And Umar is a big part of this. And then after Abu Bakr's caliphate, Umar ibn al-Khattab becomes the second Khalifa. And under his caliphate, the community grows substantially. There's a lot of prosperity and other things. And he's got a really unique relationship with his son, who's narrating this hadith, that Abdullah ibn Umar is on one occasion with the companions and his father, and the Prophet asks, you know, what tree is the Bedouin most like? What tree is the believer most like? And he knows the answer, right? The nakhla tree, the date palm tree, but he doesn't answer the question. And after some time passes, nobody answers. And then the Prophet says, it's the nakhla tree, the date palm tree. And he gives descriptions as to why, like, this is the case and how it produces like shade and its fruit and all of these things. And that's the idea, like, as a believer, you're supposed to bring benefit to the world, not detriment to the world, right? May Allah make us people a benefit. And so Abdullah ibn Umar says to his father, Umar ibn al-Khattab, I knew the answer, like, later on. And Umar radiallahu anh says, well, why didn't you speak up? And, you know, he indicates that he's a young person in a crowd of older people. But his father says, no, like, it would have been better for you to speak up. They have this type of relationship. Do you get what I mean? You want to think about that practically from your own socialization. Now, his son is narrating this hadith. He doesn't want any type of political role as he gets older. People ask him to take on these types of roles. His father literally is the second caliph of Islam. He's of the Ashara Mubashara, right? He is a senior companion. The Prophet says of Umar, لَوْ كَانَ نَبِيًا بَعْدِي لَكَانَ Umar, that if there was a messenger after me, it would be this man Umar. And his son takes a very different route than he does. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in this tradition, this is like embedded in pretty much every aspect of what we understand, that just because your family goes a certain way doesn't mean you go that way necessarily. And you can see it even in like modes that are very adversarial or contradictory in a problematic way, like Adam, peace be upon him, in an Adamic narrative of creation, like the first human created. He's got two sons, Habil and Qabil, Cain and Abel. And our, you know, narratives coincide with this idea that one of his sons kills the other son. And they're literally the son of Adam, peace be upon him, right? How does it trickle down into this way? You know, but you can see that there's distinct characteristics and variables at play immediately, even within the first family that's ever made. Does that make sense? Umar ibn al-Khattab does not make Abdullah ibn Umar become like a political leader. He doesn't say, this is me, so you have to be this. He says, like, as he did to him when he was a child, you know, like, you should speak up. So it coincides well, the encouragement that he has for his son in speaking up in a gathering of adults, let alone the fact that he took his child to a gathering of adults in the first place and is now telling him that you should feel empowered to share your voice, to share your insights, without it being understood as a mechanism of violating etiquette. So simultaneously, he's teaching him how to be, like, in terms of adab with others. Do you see what I mean? That's his upbringing, and he chooses to not be in a place where he gives indication to wanting, like, politics in his life. He doesn't want to be about that life. Does that make sense? Right? Why is that important to understand? Right? Like, just because your dad's a doctor doesn't mean you have to be a doctor, or doesn't mean you have to love to be a doctor. Do you know what I mean? Or when you have kids, if you already do, or you're blessed to have children, like, they don't have to be you. You know, love in our tradition is not that you love people because of how they do what you do necessarily, right? Because if you only love people when they're like you, then you're just loving yourself in them, right? Or the parts of them that remind you of yourself. And then that's just a weird way of being in love with you in an unhealthy capacity, right? You want to love people for who they are fully and who they are wholly. Do you know what I mean? And so Abdullah ibn Umar, he was not on the same trajectory as his father, but he greatly contributed to the development of a lot of different things, including, like, the legislative aspects of this religion. He influences greatly the development of a Medinese school of thought, the Maliki school of Imam Malik, and he's able to do that without being a political kind of influence. Does that make sense? So he now is a young person at his conversion to Islam. He's the eldest son of Umar ibn al-Khattab. You think about this in your own structure, right? Familially, how the first child is very different from, like, the younger children. I'm the youngest child in my family. People often wonder if, you know, depending on who it is that talks to me, they say either that makes sense or does not make sense. And I don't know if that's, like, a knock on me, right? But in my family, like, it's my brother, my sister, and then me. And I would say that what I'm told, like, a youngest child's exposure is to the world. I did not definitely have that upbringing growing up. But I can see the difference in terms of how my parents relate to my older brother versus relating to me. Or in working with a lot of people, how that fundamentally happens. Yeah, think about that as you're trying to think out, like, these companions play a role in preserving the hadith, but what they speak to and how it is that it comes to pass that they narrate the specifics of the ones that they are. We don't want to divorce, like, Abdullah ibn Umar's upbringing and his socialization from also what he contributes to Islam. It's not in a vacuum. Does that make sense? So here now, he is narrating this hadith that quite often can get misconstrued if it's not contextualized. And it's really important to understand, because we have to acknowledge also that there are people who, within the framework of our broader communal experience globally and historically, they take reductive, simplistic understandings of religion, and then they don't relate text to context. And this is where religion in and of itself can turn into something that can be a quite problematic implementation if you don't know what you're talking about. This is not a text that then validates and justifies abhorrent behaviors that we can't pretend like doesn't exist within some elements of our community more broadly. I went to the Maldives twice, probably like 14, 15 years ago when the country was transitioning into a democracy for the first time. Has anybody ever been to the Maldives before? You've been to the Maldives? Yeah. Isn't it beautiful? It's amazing. You should go to the Maldives if you can, because it's this island nation. In between the 10 months that I went first and second time, multiple islands submerged in the water, right? So it's disappearing. One of the things we were looking at was also like plans they had that potentially their country would not exist anymore as the water continues to rise, right? It's crazy how all of us are not only like me is connected to the rest of me, but what I do is also connected to other people. So our unwillingness to understand how we contribute to like climate change and environment, this entire like nation is made up of islands in the water that will disappear, you know, God forbid, because of elevating like sea levels that people fundamentally don't think about when they're thinking about some of these things. There's a lot of stuff. Like if you go visit the Maldives as a tourist, it's not the same as like what my trips were like when I went there. About 66% of the country is addicted to heroin. They have the highest like divorce rate in the world. At that point, there were a lot of inward conflicts communally because of very reductive approaches to religion, conflicting now with Maldivian identity and what their cultural heritage was. And there were literally people that I was meeting that were like from all like kind of experiences. But relevant to this conversation, one of the trips that they took me on or visits while I was there, the entire country, like on paper constitutionally, runs off of Shafi Fiqh, right? To be a citizen, you have to be Muslim, right? The Maldives is a Muslim like nation. They have these beautiful masjids from like the 1500s. You know, it's really a remarkable landscape. And one of the days we got in a boat to go to another island. And that's how you got around. And it's really majestic. And there's like fish flying near you. So I said, where are we going today? And they said, do you remember like the capital city where we're staying, like their main capital, the 12 men who tried to blow it up? And I said, yeah, I remember you told me about this. And they said, we're going to go visit them today and you're going to talk to them. I said, oh, thank you. And nobody with me was armed or anything. We got to the island that had the prison on it. And we're walking around, some guy's giving me a tour. He's telling me about like, you know, how certain things have like burned down, and he's showing me camera equipment and this and that. And I was asking him different questions. And I said, isn't it easy to just kind of break out of here the way this is all set up? And he was like, yeah, prisoners have broken out a lot and it's caused like problems. I was like, oh, I was like, when did you start working here? He's like, I don't work here. And I was like, you don't work here? And he said, no. And I was like, what are you doing here? And he's like, I'm a prisoner. And I said, oh, and you're showing me around and you worked on the surveillance systems of this place? And he's like, yeah. And then they took me to meet these guys, and it was these 12 guys who were Maldivian, and then this one poor guy from Nigeria, right? All these 12 guys were like dressed, you know, thobes and whatever else. And then there's one black dude wearing like black pants and a gold shirt. And I was like, what are you doing here, man? He was like, can you get me out of here? He said, I came here and had some issue with my visa, and they've had me stuck with these guys since then. I was like, I'm sorry, man. I don't know. And then I'm sitting with them, and they're all together. And I said to these guys that brought me around, right? Because the security guards at this place were not like cops the way you have like this paramilitary, like, you know, racist system in New York that endows like these law enforcement agencies with like weaponry and whatever else. The guards at this place who actually worked there were like NYU security guards. You know, they had nothing, not even batons, like maybe light switches. I was like, who's going to protect any of us right now? But all of these guys were in a cell together. They weren't isolated. And I was like, hey, man, don't you think it's probably good to not have the guys that were planning to blow up something like living and sleeping and eating together? Do you know? None of it made any sense. But I was also in my never met someone before who utilized Quran as a basis to justify violence. I just never met someone like that before. And now this person sitting in front of me, they felt as if the text that they held, that I also venerate, was something that validated what they were doing. Do you get what I mean? And why we need to study hadith like this, similar to all the other hadith that we looked at, is not so we can just say what it means, but we can also say what it does not mean. Do you get what I mean? And when you have like a baseline understanding of religion that doesn't, in our tradition, require a high bar of entry in order to engage or a high level of literacy, you can practice individually, but you can also then become susceptible to external variables. They want you to tell your religion is something that it's fundamentally not. Do you know? And our religion is in a place where the whole idea with hadith like this is to create understandings on where there are limitations. And if you have to engage, you engage within the confines and parameters of those boundaries and not just to whatever mode of excess that then is contrary to the entire purpose of it. Does this make sense? Right? So this hadith is going to talk to us about very particularly like guidance that the Prophet receives in order to now have parameters around engagement. But it also sets now very clear understandings of how you engage with Muslims and where and how you don't have like justifications for separation, but how the default is an understanding where we have togetherness. Does that make sense? So one anecdotal example, right? I've been ordered to fight, right? This verb, uqatila, is not just about like fighting in the physical sense. That's one of the interpretations. And we don't want to engage in apologetics, right? Our religion is a religion on a whole. Why wouldn't it have like a code of engagement, you know, if it is a religion that exists on a whole? And we'll look either today or tomorrow at a narration of Abu Bakr radiallahu anh, where he outlines like when you're engaged in battle and he says, you don't like do anything to like children and women and the elderly, to the monks and like monasteries and houses of worship and all the, like he's setting guidelines. You don't like, you know, damage trees and vegetation. We're going to look at that. But here, like this word, uqatila, not only does it have that sense of like physical fighting, but it also means like kind of standing against something in opposition. Do you know? So if you were to like fight something principally in the courts, right? You would use a derivation of this or this verb as well. Does that make sense? You know? So to demonstrate like this idea, the Prophet ﷺ has a companion by the name of Osama ibn Zayd. Osama ibn Zayd, he is the son of Zayd ibn Haritha and Ayman Baraka. These are two companions that the Prophet loves very deeply, right? Ayman Baraka is arguably the only companion of the Prophet that's with him from the day he's born to the day he passes. She's an Abyssinian woman who was taken at 16 years of age as a servant in the household of Abdullah, right? She's a black lady, and she helps to raise the Prophet of God, one of the many women who raises him. Ayman Baraka, when the Prophet passes, the companions of the likes of Abu Bakr and Umar, when they missed the Prophet, they would go talk to Ayman Barakah about the Prophet. That's how close she was. Zayd ibn Haritha is so close to the Prophet that on one occasion he's known as Zayd ibn Muhammad. And when verses are revealed that say you can't assume the natal identity of any individual, doesn't mean you can't adopt or take in orphans or treat people with respect or take children in who have needs, but the natal identity, right? It's problem solving for the challenge that you could adopt someone just to usurp their wealth. You know, like my wife and I became foster parents, and you could go into the foster system and see all kinds of things that are difficult, but the realities of what brought us in, one of the things that catalyzed it was in the work that my wife does with children who are survivors of abuse. There were so many children who were taken as foster children by people who are terrible people because they wanted like the government stipend and the benefits that came from it. And then they would treat these kids like garbage, like lock them up in like single rooms, like not feed them well, all kinds of terrible things, right? And if you can say, how is that possible? Well, you live in a world right now, man, where every day, like there's people who are killing children, bombing them without any sense of like remorse whatsoever. You know, that ugliness exists also on micro levels embedded in every system that we see here. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? So Zayd ibn Haritha goes back to being Zayd ibn Haritha because you can't suddenly claim that somebody that you did not father into this world, mother into this world, is your child, so that you can't take their inheritance. You can't claim that their belongings are now yours. They are always the child of their parent. Osama ibn Zayd is the child of these two people. There's narrations where the Prophet would put him on one knee and put his own grandson on his other knee and make dua saying, Ya Allah, love them as I love them. Like he loves Osama ibn Zayd. When Osama ibn Zayd is older, he is now appointed to be a general in the Muslim army. And in a Medinese period of Islam, they're in a battle, and as he and a man from the Ansar, like a Medinan man, fighting with someone, before Osama ibn Zayd is about to take this man's life, he says, La ilaha illallah. And Osama ibn Zayd has seconds to decide what it is that he is going to do. This man has been killing people, like they're in war, you know? And so he decides to take his life. The Medinese man goes back to the Prophet and says, Ya Rasulullah, this is what happened. The man said, La ilaha illallah, Osama took his life. Is this what we're supposed to do? And the Prophet says to Osama ibn Zayd, did you kill him after he said, La ilaha illallah? And Osama ibn Zayd says, Ya Rasulullah, innama kana muta'awwidha, that he was just seeking protection. And he says, did you kill him after he said, La ilaha illallah? And he said, Ya Rasulullah, he was just scared to die. And he says, oh, Osama, did you open up his chest and look into his heart to see that this is the reason as to why he said this? And then he continues to say it to him, you know, أَقَتَلْتَهُ بَعْدَ مَا قَالَ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ, again and again and again, until Osama ibn Zayd says, I wish I became Muslim after that day so as to not have disappointed the Prophet in the way that I did, right? But fundamentally, this is what it is. In that situation, you are literally at opposition with one another. Like imagine in any battle that you can take place, this man said, La ilaha illallah. At that point in time, that's it. Like everything changes. There's nothing that comes after because he didn't live that long. So you think the last thing he says is the Shahada. There's no metric to be able to gauge it. Do you get what I mean? Abu Hanifa, rahimullah, he famously says that I would rather include 1,000 people within Islam and be wrong than consider one to not be Muslim and be wrong on that who actually was. Do you get what I mean? Right? They're looking for reasons to like embrace and be compassionate and be kind to people. Does that make sense? So this hadith is giving us an understanding also on like what it means to build community, how it is that La ilaha illallah becomes a connecting variable that you now start to have this interaction with people more broadly. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So let's do this. Some more people have trickled in from when we started and there was three people in the room. You can turn to the persons next to you and exchange some names. What are you taking away so far? What is it bringing up for you? Just so we can get kind of talking, and then we'll jump into the text of the hadith a little bit. So go ahead. We're gonna go through it again. Yeah, we'll go through it once we start again. For those who came in, sorry, we're on hadith number 8 of the 40 hadith of Imam Nawawi. So if you want to pull it up, that's the one we're looking at. But yeah, sorry, not to interrupt. Go ahead. Is it working okay? Is it working okay? The noise is from my shirt. It's from my shirt. Oh, like right now? Okay, so what are some of the things that are coming up for people right now? Maybe we can get a couple of people just so we're talking and thinking about it. Or like, how do you relate to this hadith? Like, what does it bring up for you itself? What do we discuss? Anybody? Yeah. No, no. I asked you a question. You can't ask me a question. I was like, well, no, man. Answer my question first. What did you guys talk about?
We just, first exchanged
presentation.
We kind of talked about the survival of the
Holocaust. This is the worst answer. What? Why are you laughing so hard? Solo set you up. Yeah, what was your question? What did you want?
The question had to do specifically, I know it was like a little bit of a tangent, but taking of a last name for a child that you adopt, I know that like the name is mentioned during the time of prophet. Like officially traced lineage, and it was like a little bit more like more importance in how they did it. But nowadays with like if you were to adopt a child through a system, do you give them your last name or
It's not like the challenge comes in and what creates like the issue of natal identity. So it doesn't kind of factor in the same way as it did before. So you'll hear different people say different things. Like if someone converts, for example, there's some people who they change their entire name, right? There's other people who will change their first name, but not their last name, because their last name still attaches to like their family lineage, but they're not taking like their father's name, right? And that was kind of what the custom was during the time of the Prophet. So Osama ibn Zayd is actually Osama ibn Zayd ibn Haritha. You know, like they're going in that way. Abdullah ibn Umar is Abdullah ibn Umar ibn al-Khattab, right? So they're taking their father's name as like just essentially their name is a sentence that's their lineage. Do you know what I mean? So do you see the difference there? Right? So if you were taking like your dad's last name as like a family name, as a clan name, the way that, you know, the Prophet is of Quraysh or Banu Hashim or like Abu Bakr is Banu Taym, right? Like they know their clan, etc. Do you get what I mean? But we're not saying you're not your dad's son. Does that make sense? So, right? So what these guys were doing is saying, like, he's now my son. He inherits from me. It creates that conundrum. It's like natal identity can't be assumed in that way.
Okay. So what I just understood is that it's okay to give him your last name when it comes to the time of heritage. It may not apply to the same way that it is.
The different rules that come into play. Yeah. Yeah. So what did anybody talk about in relation to this? Yeah. What kind of conversations do you have with people? No, it makes sense. Zakhlah khair. There are had punishments in Sharia, but the had punishment also necessitates like due process. It's not something that's just kind of implemented in those ways. This is talking very particularly, so why don't we get into the hadith, right? If we look at it from the beginning of it, the Prophet ﷺ says, "Umirtu," I was commanded. It's very different from when a companion says, "We were commanded," right? If you have sayings that get attributed to the Sahaba and they say, "We were commanded," the assumption is that they were commanded by the Prophet. But the potential lies that someone could be saying, "We were commanded," and it could be from another companion. You know, Abdullah ibn Umar could have been told by his father, Umar ibn al-Khattab. That doesn't mean he was told by the Prophet of God. Do you see? When the Prophet is saying umirtu, like who is commanding the Prophet? What do you think? Huh? Allah is commanding the Prophet, right? So the particulars of the language already give us an understanding, do you know? And you want to be able to understand language in this way. Like if somebody is a teacher, then you know they must have students, right? Someone's a father, they must have a son, right? Someone is, you know, a son, they have to have a mom, right? Like, there's these relationships, but language also, by default, gives logical conclusions. So if the prophet is saying, I was commanded, then logically, the prophet is commanded by someone who has capacity to command the prophet of God. It's going to be God, right? If you can look up on your phones, there's a verse in Surah Al-Baqarah, verse 216, if we can pull it up. How do people like this setup better, where there's no table and we're all sitting on the ground? Does it work well? I'm a very short person, so I don't know if it changes the dynamic. But I didn't like sitting at the table. Does anybody have the verse in front of them? Surah Baqarah 216. Can we read it? Yeah, go ahead. Sure, English is great.
Why do you think he joined from you while you did so? Perhaps you did a thing and it is good to you. Perhaps you love a thing and it is bad to you. The law knows of you not.
Yeah, can anybody read the Arabic? Go ahead, you have it. Okay. We can unpack this verse and look at commentaries, but just from the onset of this verse, how does it relate to the idea that the prophet is being commanded to do this thing, right? Because the very first part of this verse, kutiba alaykum al-kital, it has the same word here, right? Umirtu an what? This thing, kital. So who is the one that's commanding the prophet of God? It's Allah. Here's a verse in Surah Baqarah that this comes. And now Allah is giving us an understanding of how this command might be something that elicits a response in the Prophet of God, right? And then principally, it also gives us something that we'll talk about in a bit. But the fact that Allah is commanding the Prophet to something, what does the first part of this verse say? How does what is the feeling in it? Like, what did you read? Read the translation again.
Fighting has been enjoined upon you while it is
hateful. Yeah, while it is hateful for you, right? There's kiraha in it. The word makruh is one of the ahkam of Sharia, right? It's a disliked kind of category, do you know? So you have fard, obligatory, mustahab, recommended, right? Mubah, neutral. Makruh, disliked, and haram, prohibited, you know? So when there's kiraha in something, like, you don't, it's disliked. So the verse is saying, this thing is prescribed for you, and you dislike it, you know? You don't necessarily like this thing. Do you see? So when the Prophet is giving this indication contextually, the companions are learning Islam in real time. Revelation is coming down over 23 years a period. They move from a place where they are persecuted to now being in a place where they are not persecuted. The default of the Prophet of God is to try to always strategically limit fighting unless it's absolutely necessary. But if you're in a place now where you don't want to do something, you dislike it, it's a very human religion, and you're now at a place where there's a challenge. Boycotts are being implemented, people are being abused, people are being killed, and then they have battles like the Battle of Badr. They have battles like the Battle of Uhud. They have things where people are actively going into battle against people that they know. Because the city of Mecca, right, when we are looking at this in the Sirah Halakha on Wednesdays, how many people live in the city of Mecca at any one time? There's not millions of people the way there's millions of people in Manhattan, but there are like tens of thousands of people frequenting Mecca, right? 100,000 people in Mecca. You know, the original city of Medina, if you go to Medina now, the original city essentially fits into the confines of the courtyard. It's not like a big place. Do you know what I mean? And then you think about this not in terms of like everybody that's represented in our collective age demographic, assuming like I'm one of the older people in the room and the younger people in the room might be in their teens, right? But we still generationally have a connection. But if we're saying 100,000 people, that's also including like children, women, the elderly. So everybody is not just like of one age demographic. They're all not like, you know, 20 to 40 and everything in between. So when you have people that are of a common background than your own, you probably like know them or know of them. So a good chance if somebody is an able-bodied individual that's in the battlefield, like you might have had some kind of interaction with them or somebody that they knew. That could have even been somebody that was part of your clan or your family, because it's upending an entire societal system that was about clans protecting clans, right? The Prophet's companions came from every race and every class and every like clan and tribe in that Meccan Arabia, as well as from people coming from outside of Mecca. Do you know? So here now, when you have this recognition, this is coming from the divine. And this is something that we are only taking them on in this scenario and in this context. It's not a proactive kind of engagement that we are going out and just fighting for the sake of fighting. But now somebody is coming at us and we have to go into a place of defense. One, they need the command from Allah. They don't just get up and say, we're going to arbitrarily start fighting and engaging in this. And then two, the limitations on it have to come into play. It's not just happening in the ways that one might assume my feelings dictate and define certain things. And the verse is really important to understand because embedded in it is fundamentally what this religion is rooted in. That Allah knows best, even if I don't understand it. It doesn't exert itself off of a prism of rational or irrational frames that are subjective to my understanding. Rational or irrational to me, it makes sense or does not make sense to me, but it interjects a third frame that is super irrational. I don't have to understand it in order for it to be true. A God-centric religion assumes that there's certain things God will ask you to do that you love to do, certain things God asks you to do that you'll struggle with, and certain things God asks you to do that you just don't fundamentally understand. And the rest of the verse is now giving us this principle. What's the rest of the verse in translation?
Perhaps you hate a thing and it is good for you. Perhaps you love a thing and it is bad for you. And Allah knows what you know now.
So the spirit of the practice is not what defines the actual kind of worth of the practice. We could sit here and talk about like the merits of why we shorten prayer when we travel. We could sit here and conjecture on why we don't eat pork or why it makes sense that alcohol is prohibited, right? But fundamentally, at the end of the day, it's not because it makes sense to you or me that we don't eat pork. We don't eat pork because God said we don't eat pork. That's what it is, right? You might struggle with it. It's not that you become the Sharia police and start saying, God said we don't eat pork, and you go knock out like the ham out of everyone's hands, right? No, that's not what we're saying. But we're saying it doesn't need for you to understand why we don't eat it in order for it to make sense. Because the wisdom of it is rooted in the source of wisdom. And knowing who Allah is then has a role in understanding like the command and its implementation from the command giver, not the command doer. So when the prophet is saying this to his companions, they know implicitly and explicitly what he's telling us he has been taught from Allah. Does that make sense? And then there's, this is just what it is. Do you know? And you get to a place where the contextualization is important. Do you know what I mean? The Prophet was really intelligent, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. When they come into the conquest of Mecca, it's not that at the conquest of Mecca, where there's no bloodshed, right? They come back 20 years after this thing started. And in the first 13 years, they're being beaten and abused and all of this other stuff. 2 decades have passed. They've built up clout. But it's not that the Meccans are in a place where they don't think that they're going to like be ready to fight. Do you get what I mean? One of the things that the Prophet does as he approaches Mecca is he tells people to make fires, you know, in the night. They're in the desert, it's cold. If you've ever been to like a desert area in the evenings, it's not like necessarily hot at nighttime. It can get a little bit colder. And if they would conventionally make fires in these settings, they've set up camp, how many fires do you need to warm like a group of people? Like how many, have you ever been to a fire, like you've roasted marshmallows on a fire? Does everybody get their own fire? No. How many people can fit around a fire when you're roasting marshmallows? Huh? 10 people. Great. And typically what would happen is that they would make one fire for 10 people. The Prophet told the people when they came, every person make your own fire. And so what it gave was the illusion to the people in Mecca that they just came with like 10 times as many people as they actually came. Why do you think he does this? They're trying to avoid fighting. Do you understand? If they get in with an understanding that this is a force that we cannot take on, then there's no fighting. It's not even worth it for us to try. Because think, right? Badr happens, and how many Muslims are there at Badr? How many people are in the opposition? And they still fight. We have the numbers. We talk about these things. There's substantially less in one arena and substantially more, right? But they still, they didn't say, let's run away. They got up. The Prophet makes dua all night. Ya Allah, like all of us who believe in this thing are right here. If we like all die, this is going to stop. There's not that many of them. So this culture societally is ready to like stand on its feet in this way. And the Prophet gets them to understand that there's a lot more of them than they actually are. And they go in, everybody's forgiven. He says, keep people in their homes. Like, don't do anything to anybody. Even the ones who are the most adversarial, right? You have a man by the name of Ikrama, who's the son of Abu Jahl. Ikrama is not Muslim at this time, at Fath al-Makkah. And the Prophet says, every house is forgiven. Ikrama doesn't believe a word of it. Ikrama, not only is he the son of Abu Jahl, who made his life about like hurting Islam, Ikrama, in the Battle of Uhud, he led one of the flanks, while Khalid ibn Walid, who was not Muslim, led the other flank, that came upon and shifted the tide of battle, right? And they killed a lot of senior companions in this battle. Ikrama runs away. And when the Prophet finds out he runs, he tells people, go tell him to come back and that he'll be forgiven. And Ikrama doesn't understand. He's like, I don't think this is what he said. And they said, no, he did. And then he comes back to Mecca and engages the Prophet, takes his Shahada, and the Prophet tells his companions, don't ever disparage his father, Abu Jahl. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you don't read this hadith in the context of Quran and like hadith more broadly, then you see where people have a reductive methodology that then violates fundamental principles of what this religion is. And this is why I tell you guys when you come on Wednesdays and we read the seerah makes all of this concrete. Like you see how the Prophet lived the Quran. Do you get what I mean? So here, he's saying, Umirtu, I was commanded by Allah. And then in the Quran, the verse that we read, Allah is saying that this is something that is written for you. Kutiba alaykum al-kital. It's got the same Arabic as like when we have the verse for fasting. Kutiba alaykum al-siyam, right? Fasting has been written for you. So when you have this construct in the Quran, right? This is one of the things that denotes a mandate or an obligation, right? Kutiba alaykum al-siyam, fasting has been written for you. Kutiba alaykum al-kital, that this has been something that's prescribed for you, right? And then Allah says, though you dislike it. Do you know what I mean? What I like for us to think about now is the latter part of this like verse, where Allah says that you may dislike something, although there is good in it for you, and you may like something, although there is not good in it for you. Allah knows and you do not know. Because not as a tangent, but to be able to apply it to the practical of this hadith, but to also then think about it in terms of where we are day to day in our existence, our understanding of how we implement religion is not rooted in feelings that become devoid of moments of rest, that logically we try to ascertain meaning that's rooted in this thing. Just because you like it or dislike it doesn't make that the basis of its implementation, right? You might like something and it's not good for you. You might dislike something and it's good for you. How you get to a place where the feeling doesn't exert the decision-making necessitates understanding what this verse means in its latter part, coming back to me. Tadabbur, reflection on the Quran, is not in a vacuum, but tadabbur, reflecting on the Quran, is through the perspective of what is the verse speaking to me? How does this mean to me? So this latter part of this verse, you might like something, but there's not good in it for you. You might dislike something, but there's good in it for you, right? Allah knows and you do not know. How is this relevant to us individually? What do we take from it? Does the question make sense? So what I'd like for you to do is turn to the person next to you and just think about this latter part of this verse of Quran, the 216th verse of the second chapter, Surah Baqarah. You may dislike something and there's good in it for you, right? You may like something and it's not good for you. Allah knows and you don't know. How does this bear relevance to our engagement with our faith and our decision-making? If you can turn to the person next to you, talk it out a bit, and then we'll come back and discuss. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Hey Zagman. Yeah, what's up?
Yeah, so I just okay.
This is all on the camera, by the way.
Oh, it's on.
Is that fine?
Yeah. If I was a new Muslim, right, and I was trying to simplify anything, like I'm coming into this society and this huge concept, this old tradition, and there's so much that's happening with it. The first thing I would try to do is would be to try to simplify it, right? And so, like, thinking from that point of view, I heard two things earlier when I first came in was the importance of contextualizing and relating it to me. And then when we're going through this, this ayah 216, I'm hearing it's not really about what I think, it's about what's said. I'm feeling like, as a Muslim, I feel like there's two conflicting ideas, and I know it's not, I know it's late. I know, like, one comes. Can you just, like, can you prioritize that? Just like,
because
that?
Faith precedes practice, right? So if you know who Allah is, that's where you get a route here to be able to determine, like, how do I, like, relate to, like, things God asked me to do? I might struggle with them, do you know? But I fundamentally still know that Allah is the one that knows what's best. Do you get what I mean? So if someone's a new Muslim, for example, you know, they're struggling with, like, waking up to pray Fajr in the morning, do you know? Or it's hard, right? But they're in a place where even, like, their sleep is messed up, and they're like, you know, but they know, like, because Allah is saying to do this, there's khair in it. Do you get what I mean? That's what it comes down to, right? Like, Allah is the determiner of, like, all of these things, not me, do you know? Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I have to be content with the idea that my comprehension is not an ingredient to its goodness being validated. Do you know?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't need me to comprehend it or to be its validator. It's like what it is because Allah said that's what it is. Do you know?
Yes. So by taking that, right? Like, let's say I was somebody who's like a very, like, averse to violence in every way, and I'm coming into Islam, and I come across this ayah that talks about, you know, striking down wherever you find right. And then I take what you just said. I'm like, okay, I can't understand.
Well, the contextualization part is where you were wrong. The contextualization part is not contextualizing back to you, right? Contextualization is contextualizing in the text, right? Like, when was the verse revealed? In what context? When was the hadith revealed? Like, or said, like, in what space? Do you know what I mean? It's not just like, what does it mean to me in my context? It's like, what was happening when this happened? Do you know? So they weren't sitting celebrating Eid, right? And so that's where the context of that verse gets taken out, because it's just read very simplistically, right? I'll go back and explain it to people again. That makes sense? Yeah. Okay, let's come back. So I want to clarify one thing really quickly, right? Like, our tradition, when you do tafsir of a text, that's kind of commentary on Quran, it's an exegetical analysis, right? You're drawing meaning from the text, exegetical, right? It's got X in it, like exit or extra, you know, you're taking out of. What a lot of people do today is more eisegetical. They formulate an argument, and then they pick verses and hadith to prove the argument. You can turn a book into anything that you want to, right? And that's like any book. You can turn it into whatever. If there's no contextualization, you just cherry pick things. This is what people do today. Look at like how there is media that splices people's comments into sound bites that are like 6-7 seconds long. It's like, this person said this. And it just takes out like a sentence in a paragraph or whatever else. That's where a reductive approach to Islam is problematic. And it lends itself towards the behaviors that those men that I told you that I met in the Maldives, they take a verse and they say, this justifies our violence against people, right? But they're not contextualizing the verse. There's a relationship between text and context. Do you know what I mean? And this becomes the limits on a methodology that says this is what it is and that's just what it must mean. I only take it without any contextualization. Do you know? And hadith like this, when you don't contextualize them, they then become the grounds for a lot of things that we see people have done that go outside of what our religion allows for. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, what do we talk about in the latter part of this verse, right? You might dislike something and there's good in it for you, right? You might like something and it's not good for you. Allah knows and you do not know. How is this like relevant? Why is this an important thing for us to build a relationship with, like this verse of Surah Baqarah? What do you take from it? What does it evoke? What did you discuss? Yeah. Yeah, it's an amazing example, right? Exercise. I go to the gym in the morning, and my wife one day, she said to me, like, do you like going to the gym? And I said, yeah, I do. And then after I came back up from the gym, I said, I don't know why I said that to you. I don't like going to the gym, right? But my intentionality is rooted in wellness. At this stage in my life, it's not an intentionality of vanity, but I know my head is a lot clearer and my body feels a lot better when I am exerting like exercise. But it's not because I typically enjoy the experience of exercising. You might dislike something and there's good in it for you. Draw that parallel and analogize it to things that are attached to like anything. Do you know? And if you get up and go right back to bed, right? Like, what are you liking that there's not good in it for you? Do you know? The emotions are not going to define the goodness. Just because you feel something, that always isn't necessarily the indicator of whether it's good or bad. You could love something and it's terrible for you. And you could dislike something and it's the best thing for you. How do I start to reconcile and bring logic to emotion? It can't be as you're experiencing the emotion, right? Like if you've ever sat with me in my office and we're talking about things where like most people that come and sit with me, they have no self-care and emotions run them empty to a point where at their wit's end, they're making decisions. And I'll say, you can't say to someone when they're drowning, how does it feel to drown? How will the person drowning be able to tell you what it's like to drown while they're drowning, right? And even if they got out of the water 10 seconds later, they're not going to be able to articulate, like, how does it feel to drown? They'll need some time to process. You make knee-jerk reactions in response to it. Then this verse quite often manifests. You're engaging in the pursuit of something that's not good for you, and you like it, and that in and of itself is what defines it. I feel like something. Do you know what I mean? I could sit here and like eat, you know, a crazy amount of food that makes me feel great. Why don't I just eat like candy all the time? Do you know? I'm 41 years old. Can you imagine what it'd be like? I used to sometimes, man, when I was younger, like have milkshakes for breakfast. You know, I loved it. It was great. And when I was like younger, even younger, I was training to be an athlete. I had my own trainer. I was working out 3 times a day. There was sometimes for breakfast, I would eat 6 donuts, do you know? But it didn't do anything because I was burning it off in these like workouts. I don't work out like that anymore. Clearly, like I don't work out like this anymore. Could I still eat the donuts like for breakfast every day? Yeah, but I would probably die next year then, right? Do you know? My enjoyment of it doesn't become the basis of its goodness. Do you get what I mean? You might enjoy whatever it is that keeps you from praying your prayer. That doesn't mean that it's good for you. The fact that you liked it. You might enjoy joking around with your friends at the expense of others. Just because you laughed doesn't mean that that was good for you. People might feel good about being racist. They're going to be in for a rude awakening, man. May Allah make it easy for all of us. Just because it feels a certain way doesn't mean that that's what qualitatively identifies its goodness. So you dislike it doesn't mean that there's not good in it for you. Just because you like it, that doesn't make it what makes it good for you. Do you get what I mean? And tawfiq, success in our religion, is when what you want aligns with what Allah wants. Not with just what you want and what you want, or what you want and the dunya wants, or what you want and your culture wants, right? It's when what you want and what Allah wants, those things align. And the verse is telling the Prophet that this is something that you got to do, even if you don't like it. And you might dislike something, but there's still good in it. Does that make sense? What else do we take away from this verse? Maybe like one or two people before we wrap up. Yeah.
I think for me, this verse comes in handy when like calamity strikes, going through something, or like hardship shows up. I think it's like it's an opportunity to look for good in a bad situation. Like, pretty helpful in those.
Amazing, right? A part of spiritual exercise the companions engaged in was the waiting for the ease. So when you have the verse, فَإِنَّ مَعَ الْأُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّ مَعَ الْأُسْرِ يُسْرًا, then indeed with difficulty there comes ease. With difficulty there comes ease. A practice that they had, when difficulty came, they anticipated the ease. They were waiting for the ease. Not like, I'm going to sit and wait for it. But they knew that Allah's promise is true. So with difficulty there comes ease. The difficulty ensues. Let me look for like the benefit, the khair that comes into it. Do you see what I mean? Right? So the affair of the believer is ajib, the hadith says, right? It's wondrous. It's strange that when something good happens, They praise the divine, and there's good in that. And when misfortune befalls them, they patiently persevere, and there's good in that. These are not metrics of assessment to render self-deprecation. They're aspirational tools. But what this verse is saying also, just in the interest of time, in addition to the two things, three things we've talked about, is that you can't make sense of emotions as you experience them. So they're valid, but you give yourself the space. So it's also talking about like processes of building self-care. How do you get back to homeostasis so that you can comprehend with the best of yourself and not in the immediate, right? If I got a phone call right now from my mother saying that, God forbid, my father went to the hospital, and it put me in an emotional state, and I said to all of you, maybe I should quit my job. Maybe I should go move to where my parents live. Some of you would probably say, maybe right now is not the time to make a decision. But how many decisions do you make in response to the feelings? How can you look for the good in the difficulty without presence and consciousness and wakefulness? That can't happen immediately always, but to practice forbearance as a tool for increasing in forbearance. So the vehicle to increase in the virtue quite often is the virtue itself. So you want to be more patient. The way to be more patient is by being patient, right? You want to increase in compassion. The vehicle for being compassionate is compassion, and it applies also back to the self. If you want to be kinder to yourself, then you got to be kind to yourself. If you want to be forgiving of yourself, then you have to be forgiving of yourself, and you take it incrementally. And vices work the same way. If you're a jerk to someone, then increasing in your jerkiness comes by being a jerk more often. You practice the vice more, you're going to get better at it, and it's going to become more habituated. Do you get what I mean? So you might like gossiping about people. There's no good in it. Just because you like it and it felt nice, it built trust between you and your friend. Let me tell you something that you can't tell anybody else. I feel a bond with you now because you're sharing with me something that no one else knows, right? It doesn't change the fact that it's a terrible thing and you're killing your own heart. Do you know? The Prophet ﷺ has a companion whose name is Abu Dhamdham. And when Abu Dhamdham would find out that people gossiped about him, right? Like in our tradition, if you gossip about someone, you get sins on your record and your good deeds get transferred into their account as like expiation. Like that's just what it is, right? Abu Dhamdham radiallahu anh, because he had a control over himself emotionally, and the Prophet would tell people, be like this man. Somebody spoke poorly about him, he would say, like, your deeds are given back to you as a sadaqah. You know? That this is a sadaqah upon you. Like, I don't want your deeds. You can just take them back. I'm giving them back to you. Even though you gossiped about me, like, they're coming back to you. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? He knows what's pleasing to God. Do you know? Do you get what I mean? I'm not the arbitrator of morality. Allah is. This is not a religion rooted in moral relativism. You can struggle with certain things. That's a part of it. Mujahida, right? There's not any one of us in this room that if we had a conversation together, that it wouldn't be two sinners speaking to each other. Each one of us would fit into that. Do you get what I mean? And it can apply back in that frame as well. You might dislike something, but there's still good in it. You might not like yourself, but there's still good in you. You have to be able to see yourself the way Allah sees you. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Okay, we're going to take a pause here. The building hours have changed. So the building closes at 8, which is before Maghrib, right? So why we're starting at 6 is because we have to give people enough time to leave so you can get someplace to pray Maghrib. We're trying to get them to extend the building hours. This is another reason why we're not doing iftars here on Mondays and Thursdays. So iftar is after Maghrib, and we can't be here at Maghrib time. Do you know? In the long term, as we build up like a core group at this time, 6 o'clock, it'd be amazing. You know, if some of us can ideate, how it is that maybe every so often on a Monday, we like pray together in the park or outside somewhere, and then maybe we all go have iftar together, right? You know, if that sounds like a good idea. But if any of you feel like that'd be interesting, even if it's just for a handful of us, it doesn't have to be with everybody, you know, we can figure that out so we maintain that. Going into the summer, we're going to also start doing some halakas and some like parks outdoors and different places as well. As the weather gets warmer more consistently, inshallah. But we're going to have this halakha at this time until hopefully we're able to change. Maybe we'll add iftar back to it. We have these other programs that we're doing. Again, everything will end before Maghrib time and in time for people to leave for Maghrib. So Dr. Murmur will do tomorrow. And on Wednesday, I'm going to do the Sira Halakha, and Sheikh Fawaz will do Thursdays. On Fridays, we'll do some other stuff. And on the weekends, we'll be doing things around like New York City. So just look out for those things. Okay. So before we break, any other announcements people want to make, let people know about anything? Yes, no. So we're going to continue with this hadith next time and get into like the crux of it. So all we talked about was umirtu, and we looked at this verse. Go home and spend some time with the hadith, as well as look at this verse of Surah Baqarah. And inshallah, we'll see everybody next Monday. If you can put the chairs back against the wall before you leave, we'd appreciate it, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. How you doing? Give me 1 second, Zainab. Everything's just on the live stream right now. I don't know if you want to be on that or not. Hey, Zainab. How you doing? Let me just turn this off really quick.